Eastern Front. My name is Giselle Donnelly, and I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I'm joined, as always, by my colleagues.
Julia Joja with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown, and George Washington University, and
Dalibor Hach, also with AEI.
On this podcast, we talk about the mounting challenges to European peace that have erupted along the line that runs from the Baltic to the Black Sea, what we call the Eastern Front, and about why those are important to the United States. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Today, we're joined by a repeat guest, our friend Andrew Michta, who I've known for many, many years, most prominently as we were the senior director at the Marshall Center. Andrew, I've forgotten your exact title, but you were a big poobah there. Yes, that's for sure. And he is one of the most astute observers of the European security scene and the NATO alliance that I know. So I'm particularly pleased to welcome Andrew back. The reason that we asked Andrew back is he wrote a very fine piece several weeks ago about the looming opening about the next NATO Secretary General. Those who read the headlines will know that the Biden administration seems to be putting its weight behind the Dutch politician Mark Rutte. But Andrew quite rightly pointed out, I think, that this moment where the Russian threat is so present, so threatening to the Eastern Front, that it might be wiser and it would certainly send an important message were the next Secretary General to come from an Eastern or Central European country. So Andrew, if you don't mind just kicking us off with a short summary of your argument, and then we'll start the discussion there.
Very quickly, by way of introduction, I misunderstood. I stood up the Warsaw office for GMF. I was dean of the college at the Marshall Center. Now I'm at the Atlantic Council. I've been around. Coming back to your question, my basic premise is that this is not a criticism of this or that politician. My argument comes from the fact that considering where we are, the war in Ukraine, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and how exposed the NATO Eastern Flank countries are, the time is really now to have somebody from the Eastern Flank to take that position as the new SecGen. The reason is twofold. Number one, there's a very keen sense of threat. To put it in the vernacular, the countries along the flank get it. When I'm in Helsinki or Tallinn or Riga or Vilnius, Warsaw, or in Bucharest, there's a clear sense of what's at stake, why Ukraine cannot be defeated, why it needs to win and defeat the Russian military, and also what it means for NATO should the Russians crush the Ukrainian resistance. Now, I believe also the second point is that selecting somebody from the flank would send the right message to the Russians, especially to Moscow, to Putin. Now, that NATO is dead serious about deterrence by denial, that this is not just verbiage, that the regional plans will be properly resourced. We now have plans that require special, specific, identified exercise capabilities. Bottom line, just to sum up, I don't want to go on for too long, the time is now to have somebody from one of the flank countries to take the helm and to set the agenda and to steer the alliance.
Let me follow up on that. I mean, you're preaching to the choir when it comes to NATO and the Eastern balance, but I want to make it a little bit more difficult. And I want to ask you kind of to bridge Europe transatlantic relations, how you're seeing the war evolving in current circumstances that are far from ideal. What happens essentially to Europe and to transatlantic relations if Ukraine slides into another frozen conflict, however you want to define that Russia is not pushed out of Ukraine entirely, not even by far in current circumstances. The government in Kyiv is forced to an unseeming peace deal, no matter who the president will be in the United States next year. So how do we prevent that? Because I know you're not a fan of this scenario, but how do we manage to prevent that? How do you convince reluctant members of Congress to support Ukraine now in 2024 and going into 2025?
Yeah, this is a great question. And as you know, I've written repeatedly since the beginning of this conflict, and actually since the Russian invasion of Crimea, that this is a system transforming war, and unfortunately too few among our leaders seem to recognize that, both in Europe and in the United States. There's still no ability to think strategically of the implications of that war. That's the first point. The second point is, I have been very critical of the notion that you can somehow secure Ukraine without bringing it into NATO. I'm saying this, and I've written on the need for Ukraine to become a member for several reasons, that, you know, all the ethical and moral considerations, who the aggressor is, the fact that the Russians are committing war crimes and have violated every principle that the West is supposed to hold dear. This is simply the most cost-effective and most direct way of ending this conflict, securing Ukraine, and setting the path forward for a regional solution to the security equation on the eastern flank. There is no one country solution here. Russia, it will remain a chronic threat to Europe and to peace in Europe. It's not an acute threat, as our documents, national security documents, speak to it. It's a chronic threat. I don't believe for a second, even if the Russians are expelled from the Ukrainian territory, that they will then sit there and try to figure out how to become, you know, a cooperative, peaceful, democratic state. Now, this will continue until this imperial fever in Russia is broken. And that can only happen with a strategic defeat on the battlefield in Ukraine. The West is wasting a historic opportunity here to redefine the geostrategic environment in Europe. Coming back to your question, look, we need to change our strategy. The as long as it takes approach that the administration has articulated should be replaced with whatever they need to make this war as short and as decisive as possible, because that reduces the human cost, the infrastructure cost, and it also will put Ukraine in a position where it can negotiate. How to get there? Well, first of all, we need to address our own strategic debate in the U.S. Since 2012, when President Obama first spoke about pivot to Asia, we have developed over a decade almost a school of thought that argues that we can come up with a strategic sleight of hand and address the resource constraints issues, that somehow we can redefine the theaters, prioritize them, and leave Europe to the fat Europeans to contend with. To me, that is a strategy for essentially American decline. I think if we lose credibility in the Atlantic, we're going to lose it in the Indo-Pacific. So we need to start talking not about the past of our security interests and our priorities, but talk about the present and especially about the future. Most of our debates that I hear are really about the past. They're reactive, they're normative. We're defending the rules-based international order. You know, we're talking in value and normative terms that don't resonate with the American public. So the first step is, this is the second front in this war. We need to have a conversation in Washington about why those two theaters, the Atlantic and the Pacific, are critical to our prosperity, to our homeland security, to our safety. That's point number one. And then take that message to the American public. If I went to a farmer in Iowa and I said, you know, pay your taxes because we're defending the rules-based international order, you know, he or she would look at it and say, what are you smoking, right? But if I made the argument in geostrategic terms, this is access to resources, to trade, this is American prosperity, this is what keeps us safe, then the next question is, what is the structure of our alliances? I think Ukraine, if you look at its geostrategic location, its population resources, it's one of only three countries on the flank that have the strategic depth, and especially the population depth, Poland, Romania, and Ukraine, to actually build the kind of core of conventional deterrence and defense that the alliance needs. And of course, the Scandinavians bring a lot to the table, but they're constrained by their size. And the Baltic states are essentially city-states, if you look at their population. So we need to have this conversation going here. And also, I'll be very harsh here on the Europeans. I'm sick and tired of listening to these never-ending discussions about how to multiply institutions. Maybe now we will have a European army. Maybe we'll create a commissioner for defense. Oh, now we will have the requirement that 50% of all the weapons and munitions are to be sourced from European companies, and by 2035, you know, this is navel-gazing. NATO has very specific regional plans. Europe, if you look at the population base, it's close to 600 million people. Russia has 140 million. The GDP nominal terms, about 23 trillion, I think last time I looked. What is Russia? 1.8, 1.7. So this should not even be a conversation. The Europeans should be able to provide the core conventional deterrence and defense capabilities. And most of all, and here my hat's off to the Czechs, I understand we all want to protect our defense industry, but if you don't have the productive capacity, and the Europeans don't, they have disarmed to a point that, you know, the Bundeswehr is the pale shadow of what it used to be. If you look at lead time for ammunition production at Rheinmetall and other companies, that tells you the whole story. Then buy that ammo. You have the money, buy the ammunition, provide it to the Ukrainians. We need to provide them with long-range fires. We need to allow the Ukrainians, most of Russian logistics run on trains. Hit the trains, hit the bridges, make sure that that poorly trained, because the Russian military, yes, it's a vast number of people they can feed into it, but it is not a quality military in the Western sense. Make life so untenable for them that the Ukrainians then are not forced to do these frontal assaults on the Russian defenses. And we gave the Russians 500 days to build those defenses. I'll go to my grave saying, had we given the Ukrainians for the first offensive what we gave them for the second one, Russians had no logistics, no leadership, and no defenses. The Ukrainian army was the highest morale, the best trained, the best motivated at that time. They could have broken the Russians strategically on the battlefield. So it's all about us in the final analysis. The current strategy that essentially continues to deliver just enough, to quote one of the politicians, Ukraine cannot lose, Russia cannot win. What does that mean? In terms of military art, you don't fight wars this way. You want to apply violence in a very decisive, concentrated fashion to achieve your strategic objectives and to limit suffering. We have work to do on our end.
I clearly got you going on this. And let me follow up with a quick question, because I think we all agree that Europeans must be doing better and that here we need to find consensus to be not prioritizing one theater over the other, but doing more than one thing at the same time, and we need different capabilities, etc. But the problem is also the money, right? We've given Ukraine enough in 2023 to hold while Russia has been rearming, and we have not moved, but neither in Europe nor in the United States, for obvious reasons, our economies significantly to war footing. So we have limited capacity to sustain, to be able to put Ukraine at least in a advantageous position for negotiations. Now that they're essentially losing ground, we would need to essentially surge the numbers in terms of financial support on the US side and multiply by many times on the European side. So how do we get there in the next year? How do we get there to convince Congress, bipartisan, that the supplemental should not only be replicated or approved, but that we need a new strategy? We probably need to surge the numbers. What does that look like? And how do we convince the Europeans to act, and particularly the Germans, with their industry, to transform their economies somewhat to war footing to be able to sustain, or to spend a significant part of the EU budget on defense of Ukraine and of the continent?
It has to come from the leadership level. I mean, really that simple. I spent the last 7 years working in Germany overall. I lived and worked in Germany for 12 years. I know European politics quite well. Virtually in every major European country, it's the leadership question. You know, when the Germans decided to declare Zeitenwende and cut off most of their energy supplies from Russia, that took the chancellor's decision. And the chancellor says, do it happen. Same with President Macron in France. In our own system, we are a little bit more complicated here, but nonetheless, it also, I think, boils down to both congressional and presidential leadership. That leadership will materialize if our leaders communicate to our citizenry what is at stake, what is happening in this war. This is not a war that started in 2022. Preparations started with the arrival of Putin. The declaration of war was 2005 when he talked to his own legislature, then his notorious Munich Security Conference kind of declaration on the implosion of the Soviet Union being the tragedy. At a risk of over-rationalizing history, to me the 90s were the Russian Weimar. You know, just like the interwar Germany, you had a narrative that the Reichswehr was never defeated, the country was betrayed, and Weimar produced Hitler and another bid for imperial domination, until finally that imperial drive was broken by the combined resources of the US, Britain, the Soviet Union, and some other participants. Again, this is not to try to say this is one for one, but Putin's narrative to his people has been, the great Russian nation has been betrayed, you know, cowardly Gorbachev, drunken Yeltsin, most of all the West. I will restore Pax Russica, Ruski Mir. He is reconstituting the core of the Russian imperial state in Eastern Europe, and he wants a deal on the spheres of influence with Western Europe. And we never reacted. Every single time he used military power, he scored a geopolitical win, and he was only slapped on the wrist and actually got what he wanted. He invades Georgia. You know, what happens? Nord Stream 1 is completed. He invades Crimea. What happens? Nord Stream 2 is started, actually. He butchers Syrians at Aleppo. He is a big head honcho now in the Middle East. So every single time, we've looked the other way. For this to change, what you're asking, Yulia, it has to be our leadership recognizing that the old times are over, that the system is being fundamentally transformed. We're in a period of protracted systemic instability worldwide. And those regional balances are going to be the difference between war and peace. Indulge me in one more historical parallel. When I was at the Munich Security Conference a year ago, not the last one, the previous one, I wrote a piece on Twitter that Politico picked up saying this felt to me like 1938. We were sitting here, you know, at the Bayerischer Hof, you know, eating good food, drinking lattes, and there was a firestorm in Ukraine, and everybody was talking about how we need to find a solution to the problem. Back then, you had two major powers, Germany and Japan, arming at speed and scale. You had Europe that was delusional about diplomacy and unwilling to face the facts, and the United States that was not ready for war and inward looking. Today we have Russia and China. This is an alliance in effect. I don't care what people call it. And actually they're aided by North Korea, Iran, and some other smaller players. So we have an axis of dictatorships that are facing us. Number two, they're both arming, Russia and China, not to deter, defend, but to attack and revise. Russia is a quintessentially revisionist power. Putin is relitigating the outcome of the Cold War. And the Chinese are bidding for regional hegemony in the Indo-Pacific, and they want to revise the entire form of global governance, how the system operates at every level, economic, political, and so on. And they're getting a lot of traction in the so-called Global South because we're not competing in the ideological domain as we used to compete during the Cold War. We're not even recognizing that. And, you know, that pre-war period ended with horrific destruction, millions of lives lost. So if we don't understand how dangerous this moment is, if we allow these regional balances implode, we will have potentially a wider war on a global scale. When we say World War II, it was really a confluence of several regional campaigns that then morphed into this larger and expanded this into this larger battlefield. It's about leadership. And unfortunately, you know, as the cliche goes, good times don't produce leaders, they produce managers. And we've lived this peace dividend. We've been, you know, I said this to a European colleague who got very offended. I said, you've been rolling in butter for 30 years. And a CSU politician, I remember telling me how Germany will lead. And I finally got frustrated. I said, you know, it's not the same thing to be fat and to be strong. You know, you really articulate a strategic vision. You have a crucial role to play. Germany is the largest player on the continent. With the Brits out of the EU, you know, the EU is a much more continental organization and much more kind of based on German relative and absolute power because the second largest economy and a key US ally are no longer there. But if we don't wake up, we're going to be repeating the same mistakes. And I tell you what worries me the most. You're saying getting money for Ukraine. Munitions is extremely important. Ukraine needs money to function as a state. It really is on that IV drip to be able to operate. But what Ukraine is beginning to run out of is people. This is the most important thing because we've allowed this war to continue so long. And what was supposed to be the war of maneuver has really morphed into a war of attrition. The army, you know, that we've been training since 2015, since the Crimean invasion, that army has been pretty much attrited in this conflict. And so Ukraine was, what, about 52 million when it became independent in 91, right? Roughly around that. I think when the Russians invaded Crimea and then when this war started in 2022, it was close to 40. I think right now, somewhere between 25 and 30 million people is what you have in Ukraine. The average age of a Ukrainian infantryman today is 43, between 41 and 43. The mobilization issue is such a burning issue because President Zelensky knows that you need those young men after the war to have families, to have babies, to, you know, rebuild the country. But the numbers are now such, the Russians have shown they can fight and mobilize at the same time. The Russian army that's going to come out of this is going to be much more dangerous Those officers that survive, they're going to school on NATO systems, on Ukrainian systems, which also impacts us. I keep telling every politician and military guy I can talk to that the longer we allow this continue, the more of a Russian database on how we target, how we operate, how our C2 works, and all of that will then be used against us in a putative confrontation. Notice how much more effective Western systems were initially, because the Russians had no idea how to respond. Look what's happening with the Patriot, with the HIMARS, and the rest of that. So the Russians are learning, fighting the Ukrainians, they're also learning NATO procedures, NATO systems, in part, and they're prepping and they're degrading the relative effectiveness of this. What to do about this dilemma? I think the Ukrainians will have no choice but to mobilize. This is going to be a huge political issue. But if they mobilize and we don't give them what they need, then the outcome will be more of the same. And then we know how this ends if the Russians have 1-4 population advantage and we continue the same strategy. You know, Ukraine cannot lose, Russia cannot win, so we'll give you just enough. They need long-range fires. They need those attackams that we're... And we also have a lot of equipment that's going to rotate out, you know, in terms of its expiration date, so to speak. That stuff should be given to them. So if the Ukrainians make this effort to mobilize, but we really resource them with weapons and ammunition, they can deal a strategic defeat to the Russians and render them combat ineffective. For this to happen, we need to stop constantly obsessing about vertical escalation. I think Putin has very effectively controlled the narrative of his nuclear threats. And because we've also communicated how concerned we are about this, and I'm not dismissing it, you know, you cannot factor that out. But I think if you look at what would have happened had he used that, right? If he uses it, what are the implications? The Chinese have communicated in no uncertain terms. They don't want that. Not because they particularly care for the Ukrainians. They don't want to lower the nuclear threshold in the Indo-Pacific and don't want to change the entire equation. The Indians could not continue to fence it. They would have to finally say, well, we're buying Russian oil at $20. Maybe we should actually realize what's happening here. And most of all, if what he wants is a spheres of influence deal with Western Europe predominantly, can you imagine a government in Berlin or Paris or London or whatever having any sort of negotiated agreement with a government that just used nuclear weapons on European territory? I mean, so I'm not excluding the risk. I think the risk is there. But I think 2 years, almost 3 years into this war, we know.
If I may, I'd like to dwell on the politics of this moment in the US context for a bit. But before I do that, I want to come back to a point I think that is very well taken about Russia in the 1990s, which you made about, you know, the sort of parallel with Weimar. And I think one could argue that, in fact, the Russian experience of the 1990s is in some ways even worse than Weimar, that you could make the argument that Weimar, dysfunctional as it was, had an actual party system and actual procedural democracy, whereas Russia in the 1990s, if anything, was characterized not so much by democratization, but rather by a collapse in state capacity. And I'll make a plug for a forthcoming episode we'll have on the podcast with Maria Snegovaya, who has argued this in various scholarly outlets. But going back to the United States, I think, you know, like directionally, we all on the podcast agree with you that what is needed is an alternative to people saying we have to stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes and switch to the, you know, whatever they need approach. The question really is of how you build a political coalition in favor of such a shift in the policy approach, given, you know, who is actually in Congress right now and who is actually, you know, running the administration. It seems to me that the practical choice is one between, you know, some continuation of the status quo and, you know, those who say that we shouldn't be giving Ukraine anything. It's been, you know, over 6 months since President Biden asked for supplemental funding for Ukraine. Congress hasn't done anything. Obviously, there are voices on the GOP side who I think would very much concur with your assessment, the sort of traditional hawkish Republicans, but they've been, you know, rather ineffective in putting pressure on their fellow Republican legislators in trying to at least get the supplemental bill across the finish line. So do things really have to get worse in Ukraine before the political constraints, so to speak, in America change? I mean, there is a real risk, I think, that people are underappreciating failure of imagination, that like actually things in Ukraine can turn really very much for the worse, that we sort of expect the existing lines more or less static over the coming months. But I don't think people are sort of appreciating the risk of, you know, sudden collapse on some of the front lines. So what do you think needs to happen for the politics of this to change?
Well, first of all, I would say when I talk to people, whether staffers or analysts here, take the temperature of where we are, I think the chances for the money to actually be passed is about 50-50. I'm not with those who say, no, this is not going to happen. And I also don't think being Pollyannish about it is it's really going to be very dicey. But that's only part of the equation. That's on Congress. What's on the administration is changing the way we resource Ukraine in terms of weapon systems and munitions to actually provide this qualitative shift. We, in effect, raised such high expectations for the second offensive, and yet all of this happened while we could see what the Russians were doing. The Russians were laying minefields, building defenses. They're good at it. And so giving them that time to do it was arguably the worst possible decision that we could have given them. I think that, unfortunately, Ukraine has now been so intertwined with our electoral politics that it's very difficult for people, as you've indicated, because in both parties there are people who would probably agree with us when we're sitting here talking about the need to assist. But this is now tied with migration policy, economic issues, trying to find ways to blame the opponent for every possible thing. This is about marginal gains in the electoral process. And most of American elections, as you know, are always decided predominantly about domestic issues unless the country is under direct attack. It's always a referendum on the incumbent to some extent. You know, the are you better off, you know, now than you were, and then the other issues. I think the border issue is particularly toxic, and the migration issue is particularly difficult. And also what's happening in both political parties internally. I find it very interesting that the traditional way in how party leadership would behave, even in the primaries, you know, whether it's at the Senate level or during the general election and primaries for the presidential election, that is very different from what I remember historically. I don't want to sound like a Bolshevik, but there's no party discipline. This sense of how deals are used to be made about who we put up, you know, for a candidate, who owes somebody what, you know, the kind of smoke-filled room image, that's missing. What has to happen to your question? I don't think either party would tolerate a sudden breakdown in Ukraine, even in this electoral situation, in a sense that, I mean, at least I say I hope that neither party would tolerate. And I tell you why, because we've invested so much of our credibility in this campaign that the fall of Ukraine would make Afghanistan look like a minor affair. To the Chinese, this is a testing ground for Western staying power. Our ability to deliver, do we even have a fight in us? Do we have enough vinegar, so to speak, and some other substance to deliver regardless of how wealthy and technologically advanced we are? These are the real issues that you're seeing here. So I hope the common kind of sense would prevail. What I tell you what I fear the most. Putin got reelected, surprise, surprise, right, on the 17th of March. And I think they're going to now push forward with the third mobilization, kind of complete it. The way they train their infantry, I would not expect more than 3-4 months, you know, before they would think, yeah, we can throw them at the chipper. That puts them in about June, July timeframe. Think of a situation, and I think Putin may do this, and if I'm wrong, you know, I'm going to buy you all lunch, but I it's from my gut when I'm thinking of how he could try to humiliate the alliance and force the issue, is to launch a major push in Ukraine at the time when we're sitting here in Washington congratulating ourselves on 75 years of the most powerful alliance. And if he scores some advances or achieves some breakthroughs, then it becomes a very important binary between, okay, what do we do with the military side? And then for President Biden, from his election point of view, what do I do here? Can I accept that kind of an outcome and still hope to win? Or do I actually have to move drastically in order to reverse the odds? So that may actually be, and I think Putin is willing to take that gamble, and we may see something like that. Also, remember, we're meeting here in the summer for reasons they escape me.
So it'd be very unpleasant. July in Washington, you can't beat it.
In Washington, but it also means that the ground in Ukraine is dry. which means you can launch armor, you can do things. And so anyway, that's my nightmare scenario, Dalibor.
You know, just to bring this full circle, I mean, it's been a very sobering conversation, but it does, and especially I was going to include this in my question, the question of this summer's NATO summit, and to also relate this to the choice of a secretary general. I'm even probably more worried than you, Andrew. I think if there were a Russian breakthrough this summer, that I really question whether our domestic politics, our American domestic politics, and maybe even European domestic politics, you know, in Western Europe, would be resilient enough to come back from that. Which, again, makes me think that even though in some ways the selection of a secretary general is a symbol, it's a critical symbol. Again, to go back to your earlier comments, to have a SecGen from a frontline state would be a forward-looking statement. It would be also looking the reality square in the face, which is something that we have a difficult, you know, again, that's been a big problem over the last couple of years. I mean, the default position is to go back to the times of rolling in butter and hoping that they will perpetuate themselves. I mean, rolling in butter is fun, you know, it's much, much nicer than facing up to unpleasantness. Again, it's not about Mark Rutte. He's been a very successful politician. It's not like Dutch politics, domestic politics, you know. Not that I'm an expert, but they face some challenges that he seems to have navigated with some skill. But it's not the same thing as being a symbol of a forward-looking, you know, alliance that really looks forward to expanding the zone of liberty and consolidating the grip of the free world, so to speak, in Eastern Europe, which has always been, has been a no man's land and remains a no man's land to some degree, and which now faces, as you say, a chronic and very serious threat. And if, just to conclude this rant, we include the effect of the summit, I mean, I like you, I fear that it will be an exercise in patting ourselves on the back, congratulating the alliance for bringing in the Swedes and the Finns, which also great, but slightly beside the point. Again, not the same thing as concentrating the effort on where the fighting is actually occurring. So framing this in terms of an opportunity that must be seized and the consequences of failing to seize it, it does strike me that this, what appears to Washington, is kind of a, you know, bureaucratic, unimportant, or, you know, post of secondary importance, you know, to an American mind, is really much more critical than most people imagine.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and again, as you said, and as I said in the very beginning, this is not the criticism of Rutte as a politician. He's an accomplished public servant. It's not about him. It's about the message that this sends. And also from Putin's point of view, the likelihood that somebody from, say, Finland, the Baltic states, Poland, or Romania would react more forcefully in the event things start unraveling is probably, rationally speaking, higher. To your point about Europe not recovering or we not recovering, let me put it in a little bit different terms, but that's something that's troubled me for the last 2 years. Europe is politically unified, and NATO is politically unified when it comes to our response to Russia's aggression. But that's not the same as being unified in our appetite for risk-taking. In other words, during the Cold War, it didn't really matter where you were on the map, even if you were a neutral Swedish state or whatever. If the balloon were to go up, you were all in. It didn't matter how far away from the flank you were. Germany was a frontier state. Poland is now in the same position as Germany was back then when it was the Bonn Republic. The Russians had 54 non-Soviet Warsaw Pact divisions at their disposal. They're sitting in the middle of Germany. And so not only we took it very seriously, we forged our exercises, remember, right, all of this, but the Europeans did too. There was no way you could differentiate yourself. To some extent, the fact that Russia is essentially a pale shadow of the former USSR works against NATO in the sense that it regionalizes our security optics, as I would put it. So if you're sitting right on the border, you get it. It's all about Russia because it's an existential threat. If you're Estonia, right, and you're overrun, you're risking your biological extinction. I mean, this is a million plus people, a city state in effect. The Russians can very quickly decapitate the leadership, arrest it or kill it, and just literally exfil the entire population in a relatively short period of time. So it's quintessentially existential for the countries on the flank, even for larger countries, because for a country like Poland or Romania, losing a war means you're becoming a colony again. You're losing your sovereignty. Well, Germany is no longer a frontier state. It's got buffers. It's tried to manage the Russian question, so to speak, with political and economic means while it disarmed in order to use those resources for other social needs and whatnot. So it's a very different, it's more of a langsam approach. When I talk to French military leadership, I hear a lot about, yes, we are spending more, but a lot of this is for expeditionary capability and not for a major land war in Europe. A lot of it is, you know, along the lines of Europe's southern borders, now deep into Africa. It's in the Sahel. It's no longer on the Med. Africa's problems are Europe's problems. We need to be able to address it. And as you move even farther, you know, I joke sometimes in Lisbon, all I hear is migration, but not much beyond that. And my point is, until we get that sense of a shared threat perception, it'll be very hard for the alliance to credibly deter and defend, even, I think, within our own flank. And that's why meeting those regional defense capabilities that are tied to regional plans is so critical, because that is the message that NATO can do it. I mentioned initially our fear of vertical escalation and how the Russians are playing this out effectively against us. I think the risk of horizontal escalation is quite high. And this may be the proverbial come to Jesus time for the alliance. I mean, if you see reports daily, you know, a Russian cruise missile that goes into Polish airspace or helicopters, Romania, you know, these violations, this is intentional. This is testing. This is not, oh my God, you know, a cruise missile all of a sudden flying at 400 meters or something. Really? This is how it was programmed to do? But if they actually, either accidentally or deliberately, target, let's say, a hospital in Helsinki or a school in Riga or something like that, that will be this decisive moment. If they reach the conclusion on the Russian side that the West is sufficiently disunited to actually implode us, in other words, in a case of, let's say, an attack in Helsinki, the Finns will scream Article 5. I'm sure the Bolts, the Poles, everybody from the flank will say yes. Well, how will Berlin respond? How will Paris respond? These will be the critical data points. And, you know, if you respond as an alliance and punch them in the face, so to speak, in a way that they get it, because that's what it's all about. The Russians are not interested in negotiations. This is about raw power. This is about hard power, the basics of which we have forgotten over the last 30 years, because we've lived in this make-believe world of globalization, export-driven modernization, you know, democracy building. I once said that we lived through 3 decades of the triumph of the institutionalists, people who argued that it is sufficient to build institutions and cultures will adapt. Well, cultures adapt, but it takes a long time for cultures to adapt, you know, so it's very, very hard. People are throwing examples at me of post-war Germany and post-war Japan. Well, but there was a security imperative there as well. Emperor in Japan willing to his people to collaborate, renouncing his divinity and the rest of it. So in a country that the United States used nuclear weapons against, you didn't even get a bad look. You got a process of change. And in West Germany, if you looked at what the Russians were doing in the Eastern occupation zone, I joked once saying, you know, if we told the West Germans, we will defend you against this, but you need to paint yourself blue and walk on your heads, I think they would have done that because of how broken the country was. So that security imperative was there. We need to relearn this as Westerners. We need to relearn the fundamentals of hard power. I wrote a piece for the Atlantic Council, kind of capitalizing on the lessons from Ukraine, and the title is Mass Matters. We've developed this mentality of precision, unmanned systems, AI. It's all great and important. But if you look at the rate at which the Russians are reconstituting their armor, right? Open source stuff that's out there, they're pulling old stocks from storage, T-72s, even T-62s. Their new tank production is small. They don't have the same industrial capacity the Soviet Union had before. But that reconstitution, they're pulling some damaged equipment and repair out of the front lines and into Belarus and other places. So it's between 100 and 150 a month. How many tanks does the Bundeswehr have today? How many tanks does the army have today that are actually drivable? Because, you know, the nominal stuff is another thing. So if you look at this, you're looking at about 1,000, maybe 1,200, maybe even 1,500 tanks annual production in that reconstitution period. And we have such shortage of munitions. And I said once to a colleague, what happens in 2 or 3 years if Ukraine were to fall, when Putin parks this wall of steel along the frontier of NATO? Finland alone is 830 miles, right? And he doesn't care about his people. Vilnius is, what, 20 miles from the border, right? Helsinki is a rock throw. I don't know, Warsaw is 100 and some. And every tank, if he decides to breach the line, takes what? Takes a javelin, takes a round. And if you run out, it doesn't really matter that you have precision systems. So we need also to have a fundamental sea change about how we go about purchasing weapons, purchasing munitions. We live for 3 decades in this, you know, just-in-time paradigm, you know, because we could schedule our wars. You know, on such and such a day, we need this in terms of logistics, munitions, blah, blah, blah. Controlled every domain. If things went bad, we could always hose it. That's over. Our logistics will be threatened. We need just-in-case stockpiling. I keep saying this over and over again. We need redundancies in the systems. There will be missiles flying at those boats. And the final point, the most important point, also to Yulia's question, we're spending, what, 3.1 of our GDP on defense right now? What was our average during the Cold War? Around 6. Europe was at 3 to 4 on average. You know, now we only have 19 that are barely, or at least have declared they're going to be at 2. Only a few are above that. The Poles are shooting for 4. You know, the Finns are going to increase. Our nominal military, our joint force right now is set, I think, at 1.3 million. If you look at recruitment shortfalls that we have, what is the actual size of the force that we have? Back then, we never had a smaller military than 2 million. Height of Vietnam War was 3.5, close to 10% of GDP. And back then we had one principal theater, now we have at a minimum 2, if not more. So my argument to all those guys who talk about pivoting and doing, you know, I said in hard power politics, there is no strategic sleight of hand. Great powers don't pivot, by the way, just ask the British. They just grind on until they run out of juice, then they become the United Kingdom. The United States is nowhere near that. So if our defense establishment is too small, we expand. If we cannot, in the current model, recruit enough reserves, we need to rethink national service. And if we need to build up capacity, we have about 5 major space and defense contractors left, we issue contract. And of course, every time I say this, people hurl all sorts of invective at me, oh, warmonger, this, then the other. But, you know, these are the realities of hard power. We have now 2 states threatening to control Eurasia, subjugate Europe, and build regional hegemony in the Indo-Pacific, and basically lock us back into our hemisphere. And if our dream is to become a Brazil on steroids, so be it. But that's also a recipe for American decline.
Well, this has been a particularly bleak episode of the Eastern Front. Dalibor, I want to turn to you in the hopes that you can shed a tiny beam of sunshine into this.
I will try. I was hoping to squeeze in one quick question before we wrap up, which does have a sort of optimistic tinge to it. So you mentioned earlier the Czech government and Czech president's initiative to supply Ukraine with 155mm shells sourced from all around the world. And one, I think, sort of underappreciated aspect of the initiative is that it has come hand in hand with an almost explicit disinformation campaign from the Czech government about the sources. You know, it's been very opaque, but, you know, like South Africa was being mentioned, Morocco was being mentioned, Taiwan is being mentioned. Obviously, the reason is that Russia comes down hard on countries of the global south that would supply ammunition to Ukraine. But it looks like the Czechs have really succeeded in sort of getting, you know, Russians run around in circles, not knowing where this stuff is coming from. And I think this is such a refreshing departure from what has been the norm in the West, in which we cede this space completely to the Russians, where we don't dare prepared to do anything to sort of throw Russians off balance. And it's always Putin that does something and we react to it. So, you know, there was an election in Russia, supposedly. We, as far as I can tell, did nothing to sort of shape the information space within Russia to create wedge issues and exploit them and to turn constituencies against each other. Whereas, you know, this is something that the Russians do in every Western country on a daily basis. Today, when we are recording, you know, the first anniversary of Evan Gershkovich's arrest in Russia. I mean, you know, again, like, what was the Western reaction? I suppose, you know, there are back-channel negotiations and Russian thugs will be released from Western prisons. You know, like, there are other ways of responding to such situations that, again, like, throw Russians off balance. And it's almost as if we lost that habit. Do you think with, you know, the sort of Czech initiative, we might be slowly regaining it? Can you point to other examples of really clever schemes that have thrown Putin off balance? Because it strikes me that that's something that needs to be done on a much more regular basis.
Well, I think, first of all, let me say how proud I am of what the Czechs have done, because this is thinking outside the box. This is finally telling other countries in the EU, stop wringing your hands. You have money. You don't have the stuff because you haven't produced, but you have the money, okay? And that should be replicated. There are weapons suppliers out there, not just, you know, the munitions that we're talking about. I'll use the example of Poland. Poland sent over 300 of its tanks to Ukraine, right? It needs to backfill those for the armored brigades. And again, this was to some extent post-Soviet equipment. Some of it was modernized, the T-72s that they called the T-91s, and then they sent some of their Leos and their howitzers and all of that. While the United States doesn't have the capacity to produce armor at scale and speed at rates that we would need, they went to the Koreans. Koreans have no dog in this fight. It's off the shelf. They went for massive contracts, and now all of this is hanging because of financing schemes. The deal has not been properly negotiated. The Koreans are not ready to provide financing. Europe has the money. This is no rocket science. Use the funds for countries that are sending weapons and munitions to allow them to backfill in the global weapons market and to get that capacity up to speed very, very quickly. And what I said at the very beginning, part of competing in terms of ideology is what we have to relearn. During the Cold War, if somebody lived in communist Bulgaria or East Germany, the ideological piece was pretty much done for us because all they had to do was look across the border and say, well, if you're a democracy and you're free, you have access to goods, you live better, you can buy a car, have a house or an apartment. So even though they spouted all the Marxist, you know, dogma, they knew. And we also were much more savvy in our own information operations than we're today. We've allowed the Russians and Chinese unfettered access to every layer of our society for the last three decades. If I could de-Putinize Europe or de-Genieize Europe or the US, because we also have the same thing here, I would do it tomorrow. We look at China as a military problem set and an economic problem set. We should also add to this the ideological problem set, because what the Chinese are selling to the so-called global South is, I once wrote a piece for Politico, I called it free market for unfree people, that we have a better way of organizing governance. Just look at the West, it's all messy, it's all perverts, weirdos, crazies, everything doesn't work. But look, what an elegant system, and you will live well. So we need to start competing in this ideological space. But we also need to get our own house in order. You know, I look at our politics, both here and in Europe, and I scratch my head. Democracies, you have to be responsive at the elite level. You have to lead, but you also have to gauge the art of the possible. I look at what's going on in Europe right now with the farmers all over the place running against the Green Deal and all the regulations and grain imports. You can't just by executive fiat tell, you know, your society, this is how we're going to live because it's good for you. Politics is about negotiation. I mean, compromise is mother's milk, right? It has to be smaller steps. And we see the same polarization here. I wrote a piece for the American Interest a few years back. I think they gave it a title, The Triumph of the Prison Yard. And I was talking about how American politics has been declining from this kind of traditional, very you win, I lose, we shake hands, I hold your feet to the fire, into this Leninist kto kavo, it's I win, you disappear. You know, I'm going to completely eradicate you from politics. We need to relearn how to do democratic politics, small d, this is not a partisan argument. So a lot of the issues I think that we're talking about when we're looking at why this horror in Ukraine is unfolding is also a function, and I know you wanted something positive, but it's also a function of what's happening here. However, I would tell you, in my book, mobilized democracies are unbeatable. I'll take them over any dictatorship out there with the right leadership. Listen, if you look at our resources, our populations, our technology, our education level, I don't worry about the Chinese. They're not 10 feet tall. Yeah, they mass produce a lot of stuff. That's one thing. Producing state-of-the-art weapon systems, just look at their submarine propulsion and the rest of it, and I'll just leave it at that. So this is a positive note. Let's get our act together, guys.
The way a friend of mine framed this was that the real risk to us is not so much homicide, but rather suicide.
It's interesting. You know, the Roman Empire didn't implode because the Romans had a higher standard of living, right? It's just that the barbarians, you know, liked to rape and pillage, and the borders were open, and the rest is history. No, there is something to it. But I always tell people when they proclaim the end of the West, I say langsam, you know, slow down. We still have a lot of gas in our tank. We have tremendous resources. And with the right leadership, with being able to communicate across, and this is at every level, especially at the local and regional level, communicate what's at stake. Stop talking in normative generalities. Make people understand what this is all about.
Well, from small scale conversation about who should be the next NATO Secretary General to the future of Western society, we have certainly covered the waterfront today. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. This is a wonderful conversation, and we'll have you back again soon. So from me, Giselle Donnelly, and my friends, Dalibor Ruhaj and Yulia Zsozsa, thank you for listening to the Eastern Front. If you enjoyed this episode, please do consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. To stay up to date with the Eastern Front, please give us a follow on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is @EasternFrontPod. That's all one long word. And sign up for our newsletter through the link included in the show notes. You can find more episodes and additional content on our website at aei.org or on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may get your podcasts. Thanks so much, and goodbye until next time.